Moby Dick Energy. Big Moby Dick Energy.
I want that Moby Dick. I want that energy. I want that Moby Dick Energy. Big Moby Dick Energy. I want that MDE. That Moby Dick Energy. I want that Moby Dick Energy. Big Moby Dick Energy.
Hello and welcome to Moby Dick Energy, the podcast where I, your host, Talia Levin, speaks with an array of amazing guests about Herman Melville's 1851 queer whaling masterpiece, Moby Dick. And I really want to apologize for taking a couple of weeks off. I had a book, Culture Warlords, about the white, not white whales, but white supremacy come out like 2 weeks ago at this point, and it turns out the book promo is very exhausting and I have one brain cell in my brain at any given time. So I want to apologize for taking the time off, but we're jumping back in today with chapters 46 and 47, Surmises and the Map Maker. And this week I have an awesome guest, Sarah Marshall, who is co-host of the wonderful podcast You're Wrong About, and the other wonderful podcast, Why Are Dads, about dads. And she's here to talk with me about the ultimate sea bad dad, Ahab, and is a newcomer to Moby Dick. So we're going to talk through her impressions of jumping in at chapter 46 and all kinds of things. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Talia. How are you?
Good. You know, as good as one can be. Amid the pandemic, mm-hmm. on the eve of the election, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera.
It's a hell of an eve.
Yeah, yeah. It feels like a good time to sort of be exploring doomed journeys, lulls on the sea, that sort of thing.
Yeah. No, did you choose these chapters intentionally for this time period?
In that they were what we were up to.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, that's just where we were. I've been slowly wending my way through this book since like January. And it turns out it just takes a long time because there are 135 chapters. So we're like not even halfway through at this point. So this was your first time reading Melville of any sort, correct?
Yeah, well, I read Bartleby the Scrivener. That's Melville, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, in high school. But, like, don't remember it well enough to say confidently that it's Melville. And I tried to read Moby Dick before, but I was not one of those kids, one of those smart children that, like, was really into Dickens and historical literature and stuff like that. Like, I was a very television-oriented child. And these long sentences and long paragraphs really lost my attention, and I didn't really read books like this until college. And so I've tried to start Moby Dick a couple times, but never made a serious attempt at it. And I always just kind of bounce off of the exterior pretty quickly.
Yeah, no, it can be, you have to sort of get into the mindset. And I guess I was a precocious or perhaps just friendless child. Devoured this book in high school, and I'm revisiting it now as a grown adult, so that's been interesting. I'm kind of rediscovering it every week. It's, I guess, throwing you in at chapter 46 is sort of an interesting tactic, but I thought we could maybe do a little bit of a You're Wrong About situation, where it's like, tell me what you know about Moby Dick.
My nutshell understanding of the plot is that Captain Ahab is a sea captain gripped by vengeance because Moby Dick the whale ate his leg, and so he has to kill the whale. And so our narrator is a sailor on the ship that is trying to find this whale so Captain Ahab can kill him. And then my impression is that Man and whale must go down together like Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty.
Yeah. I mean, so were you under the impression that this was sort of a plot-driven book?
Yeah. Yes. Right. Because it is like, it's a very classic, like, outdoorsy book, and even a classic, like, crime story in a way. It's like The Fugitive, but with a whale. Like, that was always what I thought it was like.
Fugitive, but with a whale. I love that. I mean, I think a lot of people think about it as like a Treasure Island kind of a book where it's like stuff is happening and it's all plot. But I think as these chapters illustrate, and you asked before we started recording if these are sort of demonstrative of the book as a whole. And I would say, I mean, it's definitely demonstrative of where we are in the book and a lot of the chapters we've seen so far, where like basically what you described is the story, which is two sentences long. And the 135 chapters like involve just a lot of reflection.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you can even call them tangents because you have to be like tangenting from something in order to tangent. They're just like, it's basically Herman Melville's meditations on all kinds of different topics.
Right.
Including whaling and the sea, but just kind of put in form of narrative. It's like a much more meditative and philosophical book than you might expect from its sort of reputation. And that always struck me. And it's also a lot gayer than anyone tells you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That was never raised as a selling point when I was growing up.
No, it's really, really gay.
I mean, your description makes me think of Tristram Shandy, which could be described as like a child is born.
I'm Tristram Shandy, the main character in this story. The leading role.
But it's like this bizarre, beautiful, discursive, sort of tangenting out from something, but from the same tiny little bit of scene over like hundreds of pages.
There are those who say this is a cock and bull story. That's the bull, my father's bull, and I'll show you the cock in a minute. I am getting ahead of myself. I am not yet born.
I don't know if you're saying that Moby Dick is like a Shaggy Dog story the way that that is, because Tristram Shandy, which I have read and actually like, although I wouldn't choose it first from a stack of things to read again at this moment, is like a practical joke on the reader. Do you think that that Moby Dick is finding an excuse to write a novel about the life of the mind by packaging it in whaling and whaling adventures?
So I think it's not quite a Shaggy Dog or Shaggy Whale story. It's sort of like, I mean, Melville had written some tighter sort of adventure narratives, Typee and Omu, about his shenanigans in the Polynesian islands. This is very much not that. He's aware of how crazy the book is, like from his letters, you can tell. Whaling is at the heart of it. Whaling is not incidental to it. It's like a book about the life of the mind and like the conquest of the spirit and like man versus nature and every big theme you could possibly imagine crammed all into one. But it's very much like also a story of whale ships and whaling. And so I guess your attraction to the book is sort of predicated on how much you are attracted to the topic of whale ships and whaling, which I am, because I just think it's very cool and scary. Like, I think I'm attracted to it in the way I like to read scary stories or like murder books, because the ocean terrifies me. And legitimately, whaling was a very dangerous occupation.
So it's just like, oh, yeah. And also, like, any historical profession that involves people using very minimal technology to do something very dangerous or difficult, like hunt. I mean, how much do these whales weigh, Talia? How big are these whales?
Just thousands of pounds. They're super big. I mean, they're big as whales, right? and they go out. They're not even like hunting the whale from the ship. They take these small boats out with their harpoons and like get literally tugged along by the whale and are just trying to stab a giant whale to death with basically sharp sticks. I mean, it's a very primal and insane profession that, like, also, you know, there are lots of themes of capitalism in this book, because it was capitalism all along, even in Moby Dick, because it's just crazy that this was, like, literally the primary means of, like, lighting your house.
That is, like, incredible. And yet at the same time, it's weirder that our primary means of driving cars around is dinosaur bones. So, touche.
Yeah, 1800s. And I'm sure that'll be as weird. It'll be as weird to the future, hopefully, as, like, as whaling lighting lamps is to us.
I mean, you can theoretically make more whales, which you can't say that about fossil fuel, so...
Yeah. Whaling versus fracking, a debate.
Yeah, seriously.
So,
no scrimshaw in fracking.
That's, you know what I mean? I think I should put that on a protest sign. No scrimshaw in fracking and just go...
I am not pro whaling, to be clear, but, like, I do think it puts it in perspective that whaling is so much better in many ways, despite the fact that it is whaling, than our current means of getting energy. Just had to come out as anti-whaling, but anyway.
Yeah, I would say that I'm, like, kind of romantic about historical whaling, but I'm not, like, excited at the prospect of contemporary whaling.
Right, it would be different if there were, like, a robust whaling industry right now. That would be, we would have a different relationship to this story, I think.
Yeah, like, I feel like rereading, like, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle or something would be different,
yeah.
But we are not. Although there is, like, a floating charnel house at one point, which we haven't gotten up to yet.
Oh my god, I should read this book.
This is the cusp of actually the first time we see whales in the book.
Huh.
46 chapters in.
Yeah.
In chapter 48, we have the first pursuit of a whale, not Moby Dick, but a whale.
But so, a whale, so that's amazing.
Yeah, so this book moves very slowly. Like, it took us until, like, chapter 20 to actually get on board the ship. And now we're, like, in the middle of the ocean. And so let's break down these two chapters, Surmises and The Map Maker. So they're both kind of, we're hitting pause and we're thinking kind of chapters. Not that we have much to hit pause on, like, the two chapters immediately prior were, like, the affidavit is sort of a famous chapter, like, basically saying why you would, like, why it makes sense to go on a vengeance quest against a particular whale through historical examples.
Hmm.
And chapter 44 is, like, a different chapter examining the particularities of Ahab's madness. So, like, you know, it really does follow the previous chapters pretty directly.
Mm-hmm.
And so what can you tell us about Surmises? What was your... Like, how would you summarize it in brief?
Well, Surmises was interesting for me to read with this timing because, I mean, basically I would describe it as a chapter about how to create a sustainable whale vengeance ship. Right? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, basically, Surmises is like, okay, so what's happened thus far, and, like, chapter 39 and 40 are sort of Ahab has, like, gotten the crew of the Pequod far enough out from land that he can reveal his ultimate purpose, which is, like, you thought we were just going on an ordinary whaling journey to get whale oil and money, but surprise, I'm actually going on a vengeance quest against one particular whale.
Honestly, that sounds like, I know I've been watching a lot of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia lately, but that really does sound like the premise of an episode that they would do. Because, like, just imagine Danny DeVito doing that.
Yeah,
he, like, tricks everyone to coming out onto the ocean, and then he's like, surprise, I'm getting vengeance on a whale. Like, it's very funny. It's a very funny thing for an adult human being to do.
Yeah, I would definitely watch a movie of Moby Dick with Danny DeVito as Ahab.
Moby what?
I would too, yeah.
Yeah, and in the book, Melville is sort of funnier than he's given credit for, often in like weird jokes and just sometimes unintentionally. Like the book takes itself so seriously, but is often so ridiculous that like it winds up unintentionally funny. And then there are also like a surprising amount of jokes as well in the book. So yeah, I think I'll start us off by reading the first paragraph and then we can get to any quotes that you found interesting. Though consumed with the hot fire of his purpose, Ahab in all his thoughts and actions ever had in view the ultimate capture of Moby Dick. Though he seemed ready to sacrifice all mortal interests to that one passion, nevertheless, it may have been that he was by nature and long habituation far too wedded to a fiery whaleman's ways, altogether to abandon the collateral prosecution of the voyage. Or at least if this were otherwise, there were not wanting other motives much more influential with him. It would be refining too much, perhaps, even considering his monomania, to hint that his vindictiveness toward the white whale might have possibly extended itself in some degree to all sperm whales, and that the more monsters he slew by so much, the more he multiplied the chances that each subsequently encountered whale would prove to be the hated one he hunted. But if such an hypothesis be indeed exceptionable, there were still additional considerations which, though not so strictly according with the wildness of his ruling passion, yet were by no means incapable of swaying him. So, yeah, so basically it's like, we're forwarding all these theses for, like, why Ahab doesn't just go straight to, like, trying to kill Moby Dick right away. And it's like, maybe he just wants to kill all the sperm whales he sees out of vengeance. Maybe that's...
like Charles Bronson in Death Wish.
Yeah, or like John Wick. Generally, towards anyone who might have had something.
I haven't seen those movies, but John Wick just kills a ton of people, right? Like, dozens and dozens.
Yeah.
I lost everything. That dog was a final gift from my dying wife. It's personal.
He, like, racks up quite a body count in vengeance for his dog. Yeah. I mean, if I had a dog, I would be very angry if someone murdered it, I suppose.
Right.
Probably not enough to kill dozens of people.
Well, I feel like it's a theme that vengeance plots, at least in movies that I've seen, tend to actually be a plot where it's like you're not getting revenge just on the specific parties that harmed you or killed your loved ones. You're just sort of like, you're doing that, but you're also taking it as a license to just kill people generally and kill whoever gets in your way. And I feel like being in a state of revenge quest is like this very coveted thing in American life for that reason.
Yeah. I mean, in this case, the vengeance quest is against a whale. And so the license to kill is more against whales, which whalemen sort of have in the first place. I guess it's a more... yeah. So
it makes him the whaler with the mostest.
Yeah. He's just a hail of a whaler. And so he, but also the other argument Ishmael forwards in this paragraph is that he's just very used to being a whaleman. And so he can't like altogether abandon the collateral prosecution of the voyage, i.e. killing sperm whales for their fat and such. So then, yeah, did you have any quotes that stuck out at you at the rest of, in the rest of the chapter at all?
Mm-hmm. Well, here's just a great, weird passage. Starbuck's body and Starbuck's coerced will were Ahab's, so long as Ahab kept his magnet at Starbuck's brain. Still, he knew that for all this, the chief mate, in his soul, abhorred his captain's quest, and could he, would joyfully disintegrate himself from it, or even frustrate it. So I just love the idea of keeping his magnet at Starbuck's brain. You're like, what is that? What do people think magnets do back now? It's very sinister. And I feel like this chapter is also, and I'm sure this is setting up some stuff, I feel like it's setting up the margins of Ahab's control over everybody, because then we're going to get into, you know, well, we need to pay everybody. Like, they're very excited, apparently, about whale revenge, but, like, even if people act like they don't care about getting paid, you have to pay them or else they're not going to be reliable, which is like very good advice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's basically like one big obstacle, one big thing that Ahab has to do is just prevent a mutiny. Like, and yeah, I don't know. I guess a magnet on the brain.
Yeah.
You could stick a magnet right on my head and it wouldn't necessarily influence me, is my impression.
People just put magnets all over their bodies back then. I feel like though they were like, leeches are for idiots, but like magnets and electricity will cure what ails us. I feel like that was a thing.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the term magnetism or whatever, but that's because magnets really do attract things. So then we have, so we have that passage that you talk about. In times of strong emotion, mankind disdain all base considerations, but such times are evanescent. The permanent constitutional condition of the manufactured man, thought Ahab, is sordidness, which seems true to me. I don't know. I feel sordid.
What is the manufactured man? What do you take that to mean?
I think I take it to mean like modern man, like circa 1851 anyway, when manufacturing was like a relatively new thing on a mass scale.
Yeah.
But so granting that the white whale fully incites the hearts of this my savage crew, and playing round their savageness even breeds a certain generous knight-errantism in them. Still, while for the love of it they give chase to Moby Dick, they must also have food for their more common daily appetites. For even the high-lifted and chivalric crusaders of old times were not content to traverse 2,000 miles of land to fight for their holy sepulcher, without committing burglaries, picking pockets, and gaining other pious perquisites by the way. Yeah, the Crusaders, like, just did so many raids and pogroms also. Yeah, so I will not strip these men, thought Ahab, of all hopes of cash. Cash. They may scorn cash now, but let some months go by, and no prospective promise of it to them. And then this same quiescent cash all at once mutinying in them. This same cash would soon cashier Ahab, which is a nice little pun.
I love that.
Yeah, I mean, so don't strip your men of all hopes of cash, i.e. catch some whales along the way. Because the money that you get in whaling is basically based on how much whale oil you bring back.
Mm-hmm.
And even as large and fearsome as Moby Dick is, he doesn't contain 3 years worth of oil.
Cash.
Yeah. No, Melville talks a lot about cash in this book. There's a slogan I might want to put on a t-shirt, which is, oh, time, strength, cash, and patience, which is how Melville wishes for more time to accomplish his, to like finish his incredibly long bizarre categorization of whales in his chapter on cetology. Yeah. And then we learn that, yeah. So then we directly address the idea that Ahab has to protect himself from mutiny. And so he must continue the natural nominal purpose of the Pequod's voyage. So his voice was now often heard hailing the three mastheads and admonishing them to keep a bright lookout and not omit reporting even a porpoise. This vigilance was not long without reward. Dun, dun, dun. So we're about to meet a whale. Yeah.
Love that. Was this serialized? Because there's cliffhangers in both of the chapters that we read for today.
I don't think it was. I don't think it was at all. I think it just came out all at once. But you know, it's certainly nice for me to have all these cliffhangers. And sorry, someone is printing something in the printer in my room. But don't omit even a porpoise, Sarah, when you're reporting to
me. I love that.
We talk a lot about porpoises earlier in the book. Like, Melville categorizes porpoises a lot. Yeah. And Starbuck is the most skeptical about the whole, I thought we were on a normal journey. Wicca, wicca, bet you're wondering how I got here kind of situation. And so then It's interesting that we get this picture of Ahab as, like, someone who is very clearly insane. Like, he's mad, but he also is shrewd and calculating at the same time. Like, his madness and monomania don't preclude a social understanding of the needs of his crew. And, like, please stop printing. I'm literally recording. Are you printing? Are you printing a novel? Okay. Moving on. So then we get to chapter 47, The Map Maker, which is about making sword mats. I didn't know what a sword mat is before I was examining this chapter.
No idea. Tell me.
It's a mat of closely woven rope yarns used as chafing gear on a ship. I don't really know what chafing gear is either. It's like any material used to protect sails, rigging, etc., at points where they are exposed to friction. So they're weaving some mats to keep the rigging and sails safe. That's what they're doing. And this sort of comports with, in an earlier, very depressed period of the year, I started transcribing some whaling journals, like whaling wife journals from the Nantucket Historical Association that, like, lets volunteers transcribe stuff for them. And, like, a lot of it was just, like, this woman, the captain's wife, being, like, sailors were, like, putting tar on, you know, ropes today, blah, blah, weather, my thoughts. And then occasionally, only on Sundays, she would permit herself to, like, be incredibly sad about missing her life and Quaker services. But, like, the sailors were always in the background doing stuff like coiling ropes and weaving nets and whatnot. And in this case, making sword mats. And this being Moby Dick, there's an incredibly elaborate metaphor in creating these.
I love this metaphor.
Yeah, will you read us the second paragraph here?
I will. Okay. As I kept passing and repassing the... filling. Okay. As I kept passing and repassing the filling or woof of marline between the long yarns of the warp, using my own hand for the shuttle, and as Queequeg, standing sideways, ever and anon slid his heavy oaken sword between the threads and idly looking off upon the water, carelessly and unthinkingly drove home every yarn, I say so strange a dreaminess did there then reign all over the ship and all over the sea, only broken by the intermitting dull sound of the sword, that it seemed as if this were the loom of time, and I myself were a shuttle mechanically weaving and weaving away at the fates. There lay the fixed threads of the warp subject to but one single, ever-returning, unchanging vibration, and that vibration merely enough to admit of the crosswise interblending of other threads with its own. This warp seemed necessity. And here, thought I, with my own hand, I apply my own shuttle and weave my own destiny into these unalterable threads. Meantime, Queequeg's impulsive, indifferent sword, sometimes hitting the woof slantingly or crookedly or strongly or weakly, as the case might be, and by this difference in the concluding blow producing a corresponding contrast in the final aspect of the completed fabric. The savage's sword, thought I, which thus finally shapes and fashions both warp and woof. This easy, indifferent sword must be chance, aye, chance, free will and necessity, nowise incompatible, all interweavingly working together. The straight warp of necessity not to be swerved from its ultimate course, its every alternating vibration, indeed, only tending to that, free will still free to ply her shuttle between given threads, and chance, though restrained in its play within the right lines of necessity, and sideways in its motions directed by free will, though thus prescribed to by both, chance by turns rules either, and has the last featuring blow at events.
Yeah, So it's like Ishmael's thinking a lot while they're leaving.
No, I love a narrator who's, I mean, really, actually, this reminds me of On the Road, because it's just someone going around doing regular person jobs and thinking about them a lot.
Yeah. I hate On the Road just because it made me so sad when I read it as a teen girl and being like, I was like, how come all the ladies in here are naked and don't have names? I want to be a beatnik too.
I've actually never read the whole thing.
But yeah, so let's like try to, I'm going to try to break this down, although it kind of like many Melvillian metaphors sort of flows over me. But he's, so they're weaving this mat. He's helping Queequeg, who's this Pacific Islander slash his lover, kind of, maybe. And they're weaving this sword mat. And so and he's imagining that it is the loom of time, that he is a shuttle mechanically weaving the fates. So we have the fixed threads of the warp subject to that vibration merely enough to admit of the... So the warp is necessity. And the woof, like... sorry. And like, with my own hands, I ply my own shuttle and weave my own destiny. So it's like, he's imagining himself weaving together necessity and his own fate. But like, then Queequeg, who kind of is more used to this stuff, is better, is stronger, uses his sword to weave this mat. Like, his sword symbolizes chance. And then chance, free will, and necessity work together. So he ultimately comes to the idea that, like, the straight warp of necessity leaves free will free to ply her shuttle between its threads, and chance still, like, has the last featuring blow of events. So this is what he's thinking as he's helping Queequeg weave a mat, as mm-hmm. you do. We ever weave a map together? I don't even know what
to think. I've had that thought. Maybe not literally, you know, the loom of time while weaving a mat, but like cleaning a chicken coop and thinking about trauma or something, you know? Like I see what's happening here. This is like an overly cerebral person doing manual chores. Like, that does knock weird stuff. Weird debris starts drifting around your brain. I've seen it.
Yeah, when I've been like pulling weeds in the past or doing like farm chores, when I like worked at a couple of farms when I was a youngster, and like I definitely had some like thoughts that seemed at the time to me very deep and profound while doing sort of soothingly like manual labor. And so then suddenly Something happens, which hasn't happened in several chapters, so that's very exciting. So we have Tashtigo, the Native American harpooner, is on watch, and his voice is musically wild and unearthly, and it drops like a wing. Like, we have a lot of these same exoticizing metaphors towards non-white members of the crew that are like now sort of customary to the Melville reader, but Tashtigo, you would have thought him some prophet or seer beholding the shadows of fate, in case there haven't been enough discussions of fate in this chapter. And he says, "There she blows! There she blows! She blows! Where away? On the lee beam, about 2 miles off, a school of them." Instantly, all was commotion. The sperm whale blows as a clock ticks, with the same undeviating and reliable uniformity, and thereby whalemen distinguish this fish from other tribes of his genus. So that's a fact you know now. So we see some whales! Finally.
First whales. I have page 317 for this, for first whales.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about whales a lot. There's been much discussion of, but this is the first sighting of whales. So then...
Very happy to be here on this historic day.
Yeah. So then we swing into action and we have this description of what that kind of looks like. One of the men selected for shipkeepers, that is, those not appointed to the boats, by this time relieved the Indian at the main masthead. The sailor, so Tashtego is a harpooner, so he's going to go out into one of the boats. The sailors at the fore and mizzen had come down. The line tubs were fixed in their places. The cranes were thrust out. The mainyard was backed, and the three boats swung over the sea like three samphire baskets over high cliffs. Outside of the bulwarks, their eager crews with one hand clung to the rail, while one foot was expectantly poised on the gunwale. So to look the long line of men of war's men about to throw themselves on board an enemy's ship. But at this critical instant, a sudden exclamation was heard that took every eye from the whale. With a start, all glared at dark Ahab, who was surrounded by five dusky phantoms that seemed fresh formed out of the air.
Oh my goodness.
And if this seems confusing to you, it is new to the reader as well, although we've had some intimations that Ahab like possibly has some secret dudes stashed under decks.
People that are in the dark shadows, people that
Does that mean? That sounds like conspiracy theory. Dark shadows.
No,
what is that?
People that you haven't heard of.
And like people have seen them in the night and now we have our first introduction to Ahab's dusky phantoms, a normal way to describe human beings. But yeah, Ahab has some secret guys that he's been keeping secret.
Wow, when I read that, I really thought it meant that they were like ghosts, but no.
No, yeah. I think they're Filipino.
Right. That's the problem with 19th century novels. I think someone means someone's a ghost, and I'm like, got it. And they're like, no, I mean, they're Filipino.
Yeah. <It's> like, but yeah, so it's like, I mean, but this is also very, so Ishmael earlier in the book has sort of described himself as like sort of almost pathologically dreamy and like how when he's on watch, it's like really, really hard for him not to like daydream so hard he literally like falls off the rigging. So this is kind of an example of that, where he's doing like a very mundane task, thinking about the loom of time, and then suddenly like something happens, everyone swings into motion. Ships sound very complicated to me. Indeed, they are complicated. Yeah. There's a fore, there's a mizzen, there's bulwarks.
There's a whole bunch of shit swinging around, man.
Yeah, like samphire baskets. Samphire is like seaweed of some kind. I don't know if that means baskets full of samphire for eating or like baskets woven of samphire. Either way, lots of weaving.
What is samphire?
Samphire is like a kind of name for a couple of genuses of seaweed.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's such a pretty word too.
Yes, it really is.
Sapphire. But yeah, it's like succulent, salt-tolerant plants that tend to be associated with water bodies. Yeah. And you can eat it. And I'm sure it's a superfood of some kind.
Let's put it in. I think samphire is like the next hot smoothie ingredient, probably, right? Doesn't that sound good?
I feel like
with
Amanda Chantal
and
Bacon.
Samphire.
Amanda Chantal Bacon eats samphire
totally
from like the Moon Juice City. Yeah.
She takes samphire capsules at 2:53.
Yeah. So what we've learned from these two chapters is don't prevent whalers from whaling, or you'll get a mutiny on your hands, even if your goal is vengeance. And reveries about the loom of time only go so far in the face of actually having to do stuff.
It's very true. My morals are pay your workers and give your workers breaks, because perhaps these loom of time reveries will be useful at the end of the book, maybe.
Yeah. And, you know, in general, the sword of chance swings at the loom of time. Something that I think about all the time. So Sarah, thank you so much for joining me. I have to ask you the question I ask all guests of the podcast, which is, what would you bring on a whaling journey? The scenario is you're on a 19th century whale ship for 3 years, but you can bring something from any time period.
Mm. I would bring my phone so I can make a podcast about it, and then I can do an episode about the loom of time.
Incredible. Perfect. Yeah. And yeah, I think there's sort of, I mean, as we've definitely used this maritime whaling journey as a metaphor for quarantine before on this podcast. And I feel like some of us might be reaching or have reached a loom of time moment where you just like start getting way too deep into thinking about the consequences of it all. And certainly like we're at this moment where the sword of chance and the warp of necessity are, you know, can free will still ply her shuttle between given threads? That's a question that we have as we
approach. Oh, look, there's a whale. Don't have time to answer because there's another whale popping up over there.
Ah, look, a whale. Yeah. Yeah. No, literally. I mean, that's you just described chapter 47 really well.
And probably next week.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope that there's a whale that just appears and distracts our national conversation.
There actually was a whale distraction during the final days of the 1988 presidential campaign season. Like, sorry, this is very nerdy of me, but there really was a last minute. There was like a whale October surprise. And it was where some whales were trapped under the ice in like Barrow, Alaska.
Wow. I hope that no whales are trapped or harmed in any fashion. I just hope there's like a magnificent eruption of whales of some kind, in order to draw us away from despair. That's my hope.
Mm-hmm. A happy whale surprise. I want a happy whale surprise.
A November surprise, but it's whales.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you so much for coming on. Did you have any pluggables to plug?
Oh, well, you said my podcasts, and listen to those if you want. And yeah, I guess thank you for having me and for inviting me into Moby Dick, because now I've hung out there and I like it.
Yeah, I hope that you can, you know, I hope this encourages you to dive back in. I think chapter one is a very friendly chapter and will hopefully coerce you in deeper. But given that you withstood chapters 46 and 47, which are both sort of short, bizarre, and meandering, managed to be short and meandering at the same time. I think you can crush this book. Yeah. So my plugs are, please buy my book, Culture Warlords, about white supremacy, which is my white whale, as it were. And then I'm running myself ragged in pursuit of destroying it. If you want to support the podcast, you can go to patreon.com/Talia Laven or buy some merch at mobydickenergy.threadless.com. We have sweatshirts because it is cold, and you can wear something cool like this. My other car is a doomed 19th century whaling vessel. That's the t-shirt we have, so but yeah, I'll have to talk to you guys about merch, because yours is brilliant and I just like make mine. I don't even have Photoshop. I make it like online and Pixlr like a pauper. But yeah, thank you so much. And to our listeners, may the straight warp of necessity be wefted by your free will. May you not be divested of all hopes of cash, and nor may cash cashier you. And I hope that your monomania too gives way to a fiery whaleman's ways. And I love you. And this has been Moby Dick Energy.
Moby Dick Energy. Big Moby Dick Energy.
I want that Moby Dick. I want that energy.